Now that we have an introduction to space and time called space-time, and you've seen that time is not the same for all observers, we have introduced the notion of what is called relative time. Relative time is simply an expression which compares proper time to the time spent by those who are traveling in non-proper ways relative to us. So, for example, if we're sitting at home or riding on a spaceship at a constant speed and somebody leaves us and then comes back to us, they went in non-proper ways because they had to go and come back, which means they had to change their speed in order to do so, which is called deviation from proper time, and they therefore spend less time in doing so, according to our little magical formula, t squared minus x squared equal proper time squared, or a b squared minus a squared equals c squared, however you want to write whatever symbols you want to use. So what we're looking at here is the notion that if time is not the same for all observers, and what I mean by that, I want to get very clear with you. When we're talking about the time, the proper time, or the time spent even by anybody, however they're spending it, that person, whether they travel in a proper time way or whether they travel going one distance and then turn around and come back, however they accelerate and whatever they're doing, their experience of time is whatever it happens to be. If they say they've spent 5 minutes doing what they do, they've spent 5 minutes doing what they do. We may say they spent 5 hours doing what they just did, but for us, we spent 5 hours doing what we just did, and we try to compare our 5 hours with what they just did, and that time interval isn't the same for them. Time is not absolute. You already know that space is not absolute. You already know that because you know that the distance between, say, let's look at our globe again, traveling between LA and London. Remember I showed you that's a great circle, and if you go along the shortest pathway between it, you have one arc, but you can continue that circle and go from Los Angeles to London along the greater arc, which is the larger part of that circle, and that would be a longer distance. But nevertheless, distance is relative. That's what that means. Well, these ideas were beginning to burgeon. They were starting to grow in the early 20th century. And in fact, the first time they ever appeared was in a science fiction story by, as I told you in the first session, Herbert George Wells, called The Time Machine. And in that story, Wells was acquainting us with what would happen if you could send an object through time and have it come back. Could it travel to the future? Could it travel to the past? He was really evoking for us the idea that it would be possible to travel in time the same way one could travel in space. There's a very interesting part about the story in which the protagonist of the story is trying to explain that we have to think of traveling in time and the difficulties we have traveling in time in much the same ways that we have difficulties in traveling in all the dimensions of space. For example, he said, it's very easy for us to travel in space by walking in a straight line across the room. So if we travel through two dimensions of space, up and down or sideways and back, no problem doing that. Two-dimensional travel in space is very easy. But if we want to travel in the third dimension of space, that ain't so easy. You have to climb the stairs. You have to go against gravity. You have to go up. And if you want to go even higher, you need some kind of physical device, a balloon or a spaceship or something that will rise you above the plane of your two-dimensional travel. So already we have the notion that at least to travel in another dimension may require some kind of artifact, some kind of artificial device. And this is what Wells is already bringing into our vision here, into our understanding. And the same basic idea is true if you want to travel in the fourth dimension. In other words, it's not just something you can immediately do, but we need some kind of device that will do it. Now, it turns out Although we didn't know this in the early part of the 20th century, around 1916, 1917, when Einstein was coming up with this theory, that the universe itself may already contain a special kind of device which allows us to travel in time. And I want to explain to you how that might work and why we now are looking seriously into that idea. Before Einstein and after Newton's way of thinking about the way things behave, we had a very simplistic idea about gravity. The idea was that somehow matter generates a gravitational field which attracts other matter to it, so that every hunk of matter attracts every other hunk of matter through this gravitational field. Now, this was thought to be just okay. That's what Newton's theory of gravity says. Gravity pulls on you. When Einstein was thinking about gravity, he began to think about it in terms of something which has been called the principle of equivalence. And what he recognized is that a person's experience of being in a gravitational field is exactly the same as a person's experience of being in a room which is part of a rocket ship which happens to be accelerating in the upward direction at exactly the right change of speed that would produce the same feeling of being pulled down into your chair as gravity does. In other words, we recognize that gravity acts as if something was accelerating. The acceleration of gravity, it's often called. Okay? So you can imagine, let's say there is no gravity, and you're in a rocket ship. Okay? And now, if the rocket ship is moving at constant speed, and you're moving at constant speed, and there's no change due to gravity, you're in what's called free fall. Now, we have, right now, whirling above us in spaceships called satellites, or whatever you want to call them, we have astronauts that are living out in outer space, and they are in a state of constant free fall. Where are they falling? They're falling around the Earth. They're constantly in free fall. From their point of view, nothing is accelerating away or moving towards them, and they're not being pushed or pulled by any additional forces because everything is in the same field of free fall. So, if we now were to imagine one of those satellites or spaceships taking off from its orbit and accelerating or moving outward away, every astronaut in the spaceship would fall to one side of the spaceship or another, or let's say it was accelerating in the upward direction, they would all fall to the floor of the spaceship, and they would have as much difficulty moving about in the accelerating spaceship as you have in moving about in a gravitational field. If they're really accelerating at a very high rate of speed, they're going to feel like their weight is really heavy. So the higher the acceleration is, the heavier they feel. In other words, if the gravitational field is increasing, you're going to feel heavier and heavier and heavier. And Einstein recognized that gravity and acceleration were essentially the same thing. So he came to the notion that if we can see that as so, then we can look at gravity as not so much something which is external and outside of anything, a separate force, for example, but it may simply be due to a curve, a acceleration of the space in some kind of way. Something is curving it. Something is accelerating it in some kind of way. And this is what the Einstein field equations actually say. They say that the shape of the space and the time in which the universe exists is bent or distorted by certain tensions and forces and things which are external to it in a certain sense. But because they're equivalent, we're saying they're really saying the same thing from a different point of view. We call these things which tend to distort the space and time or make it curvy, we call those stress energy tensors, because they're tensions. And what they do is they create changes in the shape of the space in which we exist. That's the Einstein field equation in a nutshell.